Welcome to Let's Talk ETFs. I'm your host, Jonathan Liss, and I've been closely tracking the ETF space for more than 13 years through a variety of roles here at SeekingAlpha.com. Each week, a different guest and I will take an in-depth look at a particular aspect of the rapidly evolving exchange-traded fund space, with a focus on how investors can best utilize ETFs to reach their investing goals. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Nothing said here should be taken as investment advice. All opinions expressed on this show are those of the individuals expressing them alone. A full set of disclosures will be included at the end of this show. You can subscribe to Let's Talk ETFs on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. Bit of housekeeping here before we start this episode. I'll be moving to an every other week schedule in August with Let's Talk ETFs as I try to take a bit of vacation. The next episode will be on August 20th, that's a Thursday, with Nancy Davis of the Quadratic Interest Rate Volatility and Inflation Hedge ETF, ticker symbol IVOL. It's another ETF.com award winner coming on the show. 2 weeks after that, I think it'll be on August 31st, the release date, a Monday, I'll be having Larry Swedro back on the show to discuss his re-release of The Incredible Shrinking Alpha, How to Be a Successful Investor Without Picking Winners. We'll get into the specific ETF portfolios that he discusses in that book, as well as his overall approach to investing, which I know is very resonant with a lot of listeners. These are both episodes you will not want to miss. Then after Labor Day, we will get back to a weekly schedule. I wanted to wish all of our listeners a safe and healthy rest of their summer. For reference purposes, this podcast is being recorded on the afternoon of Wednesday, July 22nd, 2020. My guest today is Eric Irvin. Eric is the co-founder and CEO of BlockForce Capital, the parent company of Reality Shares, an award-winning ETF issuer and index provider. For the last 7 years, Eric has guided the company from being exclusively focused on dividend growth strategies to include unique multi-factor investing and further to being a pioneer and innovator in the blockchain technology investment space. With research as the basis for Reality Shares product suite, Eric's vision is to extend the company's thought leadership and focus on delivering innovative products and applications for advisors and their clients. He is a frequent commentator on CNBC, Fox Business, CNN, and The Street, and he is regularly featured as a thought leader in Barron's, The Wall Street Journal, Forbes, and U.S. News & World Report. He also appeared on this podcast previously in a show titled Blockchain in an ETF Wrapper sometime around September of last year. Highly recommend everybody give that a listen. That focused on a topic which is going to be quite different to what we focus on today. For leisure, Eric enjoys traveling the country, hitting the mountain slopes alongside his son who competes in downhill biking at the semi-pro level. Anyway, welcome back to the show, Eric. It's great to have you.
Thanks. Thanks again. That's it's always weird to hear your bio, Fred. I'm not all that much impressive, but thank you again. Good to be here.
Yeah. It's good to give the listeners a little bit of context, yeah. But I'm sure what you have to say will be a lot more interesting than what you've done previously. So, yeah, definitely. So, I've been starting out lately by asking guests to spend a bit of time talking about how their work lives have changed as a result of COVID-19, and also because guests have been are a pretty geographically diverse group, to speak a bit about the economic situation locally where you are to help listeners get a sense of what the reality on the ground is in various places. So how's the situation in San Diego economically, socially, and how has your life changed due to COVID-19?
So San Diego I'll start with how has it changed in the investment world. We have all of the regulations way in advance to where we constantly have to do the testing of disaster recovery scenarios and offsite locations. And so from that perspective, we were pretty much like ready to rock and roll. And everyone was like, every quarter we have to work from home just to test out all the systems. So from that perspective, most of the investment industry has just clicked on without a glitch. From a life perspective, it's surreal, as everyone I'm sure agrees, just, you know, driving on the freeways and having hardly anyone around. It's just totally surreal. That's probably the best term. San Diego as a whole is not as concentrated as like New York was. So when things were getting really bad there in New York, that was a good eye opener, I think, for the San Diegans. Just like when things were getting so difficult in France and Italy, it was a big eye opener for the Americans. I think the same thing was true for San Diego. So it's almost like we had these precursors that we, you know, were able to warn ourselves that, hey, this is the real deal. This is serious. Take it seriously. And San Diegans have, fortunately.
Yeah, I guess not so necessarily in all of California.
No, there's plenty of San Diegans too that are casual and fighting it. I saw in the news a ticker, I haven't even dug into it yet, that we just crossed New York in terms of total cases. I don't know if that's on the day or if that's total cases.
I think that's total actually, although California does have a much larger population than New York, but still, I guess not a record you want to overtake.
Yeah, exactly. So this is going to be some trying times. The governor recently shut us back down, but I noticed that the freeways are just about as congested as they were prior to him shutting us back down. It's not like it was previously when they shut us down. Certainly the restaurants and all the businesses are hurting significantly, but you know, we're getting through it. We're a good, San Diego's a pretty neat community of just good people, and everybody's helping their neighbors, and it's a neat place to live. I'm lucky to be here.
Nice. It's good to hear. And of course, the economic carnage has not necessarily translated into stock market carnage. So that's, you know, something we probably will get into at some point. So last time you were here, we had a really great discussion about blockchain technology and an ETF wrapper. I do recommend listeners go back and listen to that. That's going to be a totally different conversation than we're about to have here. We're going to focus this conversation on some of the dividend products that your firm has released, Reality Shares. I'm referring specifically to the DivCon Leaders Dividend ETF, ticker symbol LEAD, and the DivCon Dividend Defenders ETF, ticker symbol DFND. Great ticker symbols, of course. I'd expect nothing less from you guys.
Thank you.
How does the methodology work for these funds? I know there are two different approaches to a single underlying ranking methodology. So how does the DivCon methodology work?
Yeah, I think that's the best place to start really is in that DivCon system. And the spirit of where DivCon came from is a better way to identify who is going to grow their dividends in the future, as opposed to most of the dividend growth methodologies, which are centered around who did grow their dividends in the past, which I think is a massive problem in the dividend growth space, is that that's clever and catchy from a marketing perspective. The dividend aristocrats, for example, these are the companies that grew their dividends for 25 years in a row. Well, so what if they cut their dividends tomorrow, right? That's kind of the key. And there really wasn't a good system out there to forecast future dividend growth. We looked at dividend estimates, we looked at, you know, credit scores, we looked at all sorts of different factors, and we finally came down to around 7 different characteristics of businesses that are pretty highly correlated to future dividend growth. And no one factor or characteristic was perfect in like all environments. But when you put the 7 factors together into a model, it comes out with a really predictive algorithm to score these companies based on their future dividend growth. So in the DEFCON, if you're familiar in the US, we have this DEFCON rating system, which is a defense condition. It's kind of 5 is good and healthy, and then all the way down to DEFCON 1, which is, you know, get ready for all out nuclear war. The thing is what we did there for DivCon, where it's DivCon 5 is, hey, this is a really healthy business with a really high probability of growing its dividends in the next 12 months. In fact, if you're in that DivCon 5 bucket, your average dividend growth rate is almost double that of the S&P 500. And I think there's really been three or four dividend cuts over the past 20 years in that system. So really, really strong. And then on the flip side, DivCon 1 is a high, high probability of dividend cuts in the future. This is based on the S&P 500 companies. So, you know, these are already pretty healthy businesses to make it into the S&P 500, but almost 30 to 40% of the companies in that DivCon 1 bucket end up cutting their dividends in the next 12 months. So it's a really strong system. And then that becomes the ranking classification for these two ETFs or these two indexes. Lead is just buy those high quality DivCon 5 companies, hold them, and then rebalance the portfolio once a year. Defend is a more defensive approach. So buy those high quality companies, but also take a little short position in those worst companies, those DivCon 1 companies, just in case the ship hits the sand and the markets start to sell off. And that's going to be a more defensive portfolio to kind of protect you in those big sell-offs.
Sure. And before we get into the specific strategies in each of the funds there, I'd love to discuss the methodology a bit more. So you discussed those dividend aristocrats, those companies that have raised dividends for 25 or more years. And of course, that's really a backward-looking sort of thing. In the DivCon methodology, you're identifying companies likely to cut. In terms of companies likely to grow their dividends, is there any requirement for them to have already been doing that? Or are you really just looking at every single company out there with a blank slate saying, okay, they've been paying a dividend for 5 years at this point, and they've grown it a little, but we think that there's the basis here for them eventually becoming a dividend aristocrat. In other words, everybody talks about the aristocrats, but it would be really great if you could get in on those companies in year one or year five of the 25 years of growth and not only once they've already kind of plateaued at that high level there.
Well, and that's kind of the point. Is it's funny because the aristocrats' dividend growth rate on average is, if you just take, you know, the companies that are that dividend aristocrat status, they grow their dividends on average less than the S&P 500 in terms of growth. So, and it makes sense intuitively. These are companies that are tired. They, you know, Apple isn't going to make it to that list for another 12 or 13 years. None of the banks are going to be in that list for a very long time because they cut their dividends back in 2008, 2009.
Yeah, sure.
And yet those are the companies that generally have the highest growth rates, which is really what you're looking for. If you know, it's not necessarily did you grow your dividends, it's how much did you grow your dividends and how much can you continue to grow your dividends. So you mentioned, like, are there any particular factors that have a characteristic? And again, we're quants by nature, so it's got to be math-based, rule-based, you know, systematic. Like, basically anybody could take this methodology and go build it and replicate it exactly to a T without, we don't want to put any human emotion or kind of extra secret sauce on top of things. We just want to be very transparent and build systems that we can trust, because that's, you know, in my investing lifetime, every mistake I've ever made has been based on human emotion, not necessarily because of rules. The things that drive this, and anyone can find these on our website, we list all the factors, but dividend history does play a part. So the last 5 years of dividend growth is generally predictive of whether or not the company is going to continue to grow its dividends. So that's one of these seven factors. Incidentally, that has very little correlation to future dividend growth when markets get tough. So that's, I mean, it helps, but it's definitely not the primary factor. Is, you know, like a third of the dividend aristocrats cut their dividends during the financial crisis. But a third of the nobility ended up cutting their dividends. So it doesn't really help if you're just driving down the road looking in the rearview mirror. You got to look forward. So dividend estimates is also one of the predictors. And dividend estimates actually, ironically, is a really bad predictor when things get rough that you know, it's pretty good in good times because analysts are just saying what was the previous dividend growth rate and then driving that forward. But analysts often miss those big crises like we had recently. Free cash flow to dividends. So looking at how much free cash flow the business generates instead of how much earnings the business generates, because a lot of those earnings might not necessarily be real cash, and then relative to its current dividend payout. So that's another thing to note is a lot of these companies with that high dividend DivCon score, they don't necessarily have high dividend yield. It's high dividend growth potential. And we feel like that's one of the primary drivers of total return is the ability to grow those dividends a lot in the future. So it might not be all yield based. It could be a low yield with a high growth potential. That's just a recipe for a high quality business that I might want to own. So free cash flow, the earnings per share growth over the last 5 years. So it's kind of this trend of momentum. How has the business been doing lately? How is it continuing to grow going forward? Share buybacks also is a nice driver. So a company with a lot of share buybacks and a small dividend has a much higher probability of growing the dividend in the future because they could just cut the buyback. You know, the buyback is not as sacred as the dividends for most shareholders.
Yeah.
And so that's it's almost like two bullets in the chamber. And if one fails, you've got a backup. That's how we see the buybacks. And then Bloomberg has its own dividend health rating system. So we also incorporate that into the system. And finally, and this one is the most important factor when times are tough. It's not very helpful other times, but when times get tough, it's the Altman Z score. Ed Altman was, he's really kind of the father of distressed investing back in the junk bond days in the 80s. He came up with this system, and I think of it almost like a FICO score for stocks. So it's really like a credit score and the ability of the company to repay its debt in the future. And so the Altman Z score also filters into this, and it's kind of, like I say, a credit rating for a company. And when you put all those seven ingredients together, you end up with a cake that's a lot more palatable than any one ingredient in particular. And so that's really what makes up this DivCon score to rank companies and their ability to kind of really be healthy. And so obviously from a stock investor's perspective, those are the companies I either want to avoid, you know, on the bad side or vice versa, own on the good side.
Yeah, no, really interesting and interesting how the different items go together there. So let's say something like buybacks that you'd maybe think would come at the price of raising dividends actually turns out to be the reverse, that's another safety valve a company has in tough times. And again, they're going to be more likely to cut that than a dividend just based on what their shareholders are likely to be more upset about. In terms of how these all come together, is this kind of an equally weighted situation? Can any one of these scores, if they show up too low, knock something out of the list of DivCon contenders? How does that work exactly in terms of how the seven different factors come together?
They all go into a final score that adds up to 100. So there being seven factors, a couple of the factors have a little bit higher weight than the others, but it's static. So that's historical dividend growth, historical earnings growth, and then the other five factors are each equally weighted. So if you look at that system, you'll get a score of essentially 100 when you add them all up if you were a perfect company in every single category. Now, they're relative too. So if I take the 500 companies, let's just say we had one factor. If I take the 500 companies and I rank them based on expectations for dividend growth, then there's going to be a company at the top and a company at the bottom. But maybe it's 2008 and the market is really expecting dividend cuts across the board, even at the highest levels. And so these are the best companies in a weakened market versus say 2014, where, you know, the 500th company has almost as good of a score as the first company in 2008. So it's kind of relative to time. And again, you're ranking companies, so you have to rank them against each other. And so that's what we're doing, is we're ranking every single company based on those factors and then selecting only those companies with the highest scores.
Interesting. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It would have to be relative because different markets obviously produce very different conditions.
Yeah.
So in terms of just getting a snapshot of what things look like right now overall, I think listeners will be very interested in this. How do the current rankings break down in terms of sector and market cap size basis?
Yeah, so overweight industrials, healthcare, tech, financials, and then underweights in consumer discretionaries, staples, utilities, energy, big underweights across there. That's actually the areas where some of the short positions are in the other ETF that shorts. But interestingly too, is it's not, we don't put any sector constraints on the fund, and yet, mm-hmm. It ends up being pretty diverse. So we end up with about eight or so of the, and this is over time, eight or so of the different sectors are represented on the long side in the DivCon 5 bucket. And then usually it's at least three, sometimes as many as, I think right now there's almost eight different sectors represented in the DivCon 1 bucket in the short side of things. So it's mm-hmm. kind of interesting. It's almost like, and we put quite a few cool tools on one of our websites, on the Reality Shares Advisors website. We can leave it in the show notes later, but realityshareadvisors.com, where we show all of the DivCon scores for all of the companies in the S&P 500, but then we do it on a sector basis, and you can kind of drill down to see over time how that has changed. Like, say in 2008, a lot of the financials had DivCon 1s. And right now, a lot of the energy stocks, the cyclicals, the discretionary stocks are all floating down into that DivCon 1 bucket because obviously, sure. You know, that they're gonna suffer.
Yeah, they're hoping to stay solvent, many of them.
Exactly.
So dividend is almost the least of their concerns.
Exactly.
To some extent.
And yeah. Also important to note too is a system is a system, and it's only as good as you know, what it knows. And so no system really that I've ever developed takes into account Fed actions or government interventions. And you know, so that's always like a risk, is that it may be predicting dividend cuts across all the energy stocks, and then there's a huge Fed intervention or government intervention where they save all of the energy companies and just offer massive bailouts. So there's always risk to any strategy, and that we
sure. Although to be fair, that also happened in 2008-2009.
Exactly.
And those kinds of bailouts almost always involve the kinds of strings that say, "Okay, we're giving you money, but you're not paying a dividend or buying your own stock back while you have public money propping your company."
Yep, that's exactly right. And
yeah,
but it is interesting, and it's been I'm pretty proud of it. You know, The narrative behind why we even did this is we manage another fund that's based on a market called the dividend swap market, where you have to actually make a bet on where the dividends of the S&P 500 will be. And again, we just couldn't find any good research on what the dividends would be, because you know, none of the models were very predictive. So that's why we built DivCon. We weren't trying to pick better stocks. We weren't trying to create a strategy to identify companies. We were just trying to predict better dividend growth rates. And then we started to say, let's look at these stocks. I bet you that there's some good stocks in here. And that's when we, really turned it into a system for selecting stocks and vice versa, just avoiding stocks.
Sure. And then before we move on to the specific funds and some of the holdings and how things actually play out inside of the ETF wrapper, what is turnover like in the rankings? So how often are you rerunning the rankings? And then how often are the underlying indexes being reconstituted as a result?
I'll answer it in two ways. For the Seeking Alpha folks that are interested in kind of following the models and building their own portfolios and kind of tweaking it, that we update on our website every quarter. So we update the models every month personally, but we post them and publish the updated rankings every quarter. Mm-hmm. In the indexes and the funds and the strategies that we run for public money, those we only update once a year. And it doesn't matter too much. If you were to build the portfolio of DivCon 5 companies and rebalance every single quarter versus the DivCon 5 companies rebalanced once a year, it would have been different holdings and whatnot, but you would have ended up with maybe 50 to 100 basis points of kind of annualized alpha over the annual rebalance. And depending on your taxes, you know, that might have been offset. We get to do some magic in an ETF where we could take advantage of that. But just the same, we just felt like an annual rebalance made sense for the indexes, for the underlying funds. So turnover-wise percentage, it's pretty high. It's around 70% or so even on an annual basis. On a quarterly basis, I'd say it's more like 5 to 7% per quarter that gets turned over. So that'd be, and it'd be on the bubble too. It would be like a DivCon 5 company would kind of float down into the DivCon 4 or vice versa. 4 would float up into DivCon 5. Incidentally, if you just ranked the S&P 500 by DivCon and owned all 500 companies, you'd still outperform the S&P 500 by a fair margin. It's almost like 200 basis points per year just owning all 500 companies. So it's not like you have to rank every single stock in the DivCon 5 category and then that's where the magic happens. It's just that's where more of the magic happens.
Yeah, totally. It makes a lot of sense.
Whether you're an expert or a novice closed-end fund and exchange-traded fund investor, you've come to the right place with the CEF ETF Income Laboratory run by Seeking Alpha author Stanford Chemist. The goal is to help investors benefit from income and arbitrage strategies in CEFs and ETFs, all without having to be an expert, because Stanford Chemist and his team do the heavy lifting for you. That sounds like something you'd be interested in. I hope you'll consider joining CEF ETF Income Laboratory. The service is currently offering a 2-week free trial, so you can check it out without paying a dime. To learn more about CEF ETF Income Laboratory, go to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and look for CEF ETF Income Laboratory there, or enter Stanford Chemist or CEF ETF Income Library into the search bar at the top of the site. And we're back.
All right, so I'd love to move over to the specific funds here, and I will first tout the performance. You are probably not allowed to do that for compliance reasons, but I can say whatever I want about them. So I'm going to just hold out both the year-to-date and then the 1 and 3 year performance also. So your fund lead is up 8% year-to-date. I pulled these just a couple days ago, so they still should be relatively accurate. And that's versus a flat return on a fund like SPY or a loss of 6.4% on a fund like DIA, which tracks the Dow 30. And then DFND is up more than 10.6% year-to-date. So again, really just terrific performance here. When you pull back a little further and look out 1 year and 3 year, lead has actually done better over those periods of time. And again, just absolutely crushed the broad benchmark. So if you're looking at a 3 year performance on lead, it's over 46% versus 31% for SPY or 23.3% for DIA. And then Defend is over 38% over that same period. So really phenomenal returns here. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. That's it gives me goosebumps too, because it's so, you know, hard obviously to outperform the market, especially using kind of the market stocks, right? If you limit yourself to the market's universe and yet you still are able to outperform, it's nice to see the results come out. And Defend actually did that with about half of the volatility of the S&P 500. So,
That's significant also for people that don't want those drawdowns to be as big. You know, obviously that's a big characteristic. Also lets you sleep easy at night and not do something stupid on the behavioral side, like we were discussing earlier, and panic sell at the worst possible time, lock in losses that are just on paper, that sort of thing. So I'd love to get into the current holdings of these funds. In terms of first those DivCon 5 category stocks. What are some of the key standouts in that group right now that have been driving this year-to-date performance, and then I guess the longer-term performance also?
Yeah, so I'll mention some of the holdings that are in the fund today, and then also some that have been kind of long-term DivCon 5s, 4s, you know, that just bounced back and forth in and out of those categories that most people would likely know, and then some that maybe people maybe never even heard of, because I think there's an entertainment aspect to investing too, and really like finding new companies and finding new methods and methodologies, I think is really appealing to a lot of people. So West Pharmaceuticals, Eli Lilly, those are two of the names that are in the top DivCon, you know, companies right now. And it's also interesting, you know, to note that they're moving quite a bit, obviously, on the COVID research and everything.
Yeah.
Activision Blizzard, which is the gaming company. So this is also...
Lord knows they've done well as a result of COVID.
Exactly.
Also, I mean, video games.
And it's funny, too, you know, obviously, DivCon has no idea that COVID was coming. These companies were selected back in December of last year, because that's when the indexes rebalance. It's really a testament to these businesses and their strong cash flows, their strong earnings growth rates, their credit ratings, you know, the buybacks. It's just like all of those things go into selecting really good businesses that just so happen to be well positioned for future growth. On the negative side of the longs, this is where DivCon, you know, again, doesn't have visibility into a virus pandemic. Is Ross Stores. So that was one that was one of the first. Ross Stores and TJ Maxx and Estee Lauder actually were the three companies that cut dividends this year, that are the only three companies to have ever cut dividends since we've been running the research going back to all the way in 2000. So they're the only DivCon 5 companies that have ever cut dividends when they were rated DivCon 5, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah,
but like you point out, you know, you can still have a fail and have some dramatic outperformance, because those other, you know, models that you're competing against, that whether they be the S&P 500 or the Dividend Aristocrats, they just have more fails, and so it's kind of testament to that. Microsoft has been in this DivCon 5 bucket for quite some time now. It's just amazing. I started in the business in the mid 90s and watched kind of Microsoft grow and become too big and bloated and not really know where they were and who they were. And then they just made this absolute turnaround from the .com, you know, blow up till now, with, you know, embracing open source technology, embracing, you know, blockchain, like all of the things that I think are going to be huge in the future. And Microsoft has really done well. So continues to be one of the top DivCon rated companies over time. On the negative side is, as you might imagine, so Williams Co., Conagra, which was kind of interesting to me, because I always thought of Conagra as a really kind of a core business that isn't going to be shaken up, and they've experienced quite a bit of weakness lately. Kraft Heinz, who also cut their dividends. Incidentally, there's about 15 companies in the DivCon 1 bucket in the portfolios, and over half of them have cut their dividend, or half of them exactly have cut their dividends already this year, versus
since December.
Yeah,
you're saying,
right? So versus 3 out of 55 or so on the long side, and then in the S&P 500, I think we're up to about 10 to 15%. So you know, the lead portfolio obviously is a much healthier ranking in terms of dividend growth, and then vice versa on the downside, that the DivCon 1 bucket has significantly experienced the weakness that we might have expected in that category.
Sure, and I do wonder if maybe on the, you know, once COVID-19 passes, and hopefully it'll be sooner rather than later, if there would be some kind of a logic and maybe revisiting the once a year rebalance when special circumstances happen. So not to re-rank things per se, but if a company actually goes ahead and cuts a dividend, maybe it's time to remove it sooner from the five category than to leave it in the fund for
That actually is one of the reasons why we really open sourced the entire model to the world, is so people could kind of innovate off of it. Like, there's, you know, we're a small firm, so we only have so many people, but I have so many different angles that I would love to pursue. For example, like a high yield, high div fund strategy, or vice versa. Maybe after the company cuts, maybe that's actually when you want to start looking at them because now the company is actually being responsible. It's those irresponsible companies that fight the dividend cut for so long, and just burn cash when they should be saving cash. And some of those, you might want to reward those companies after the cut, right? It's if they're going to cut is when I want to sell the stock. Once they've cut, maybe, or at least within a couple of years, maybe the turnaround has occurred. So I'd love to do...
I was going
to
say, yeah, it depends how much they cut also, right? Because it's not uncommon to see a company cut, but only cut their dividend by 20 or 30%, and then that wasn't enough, and they cut again and again over the next, you know, 6 months or a year. So it's not always the dividend is just cut entirely overnight. Sometimes it's a gradual process to get to what the final resting place of the dividend is going to be before they're able to start turning things around. So I'm not sure just seeing one cut would necessarily be enough to know that they are turning things around.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The because one of the factors obviously is historical dividend growth, and so if you cut once, then that's, you know, that's painful. But we did the research, and I remember it was over half of the companies that cut once cut again, because they just, you know, they're humans, and they felt like, oh, well, if we just do a little, and they were always too optimistic, and so ended up having to cut again and again and again until finally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like you say.
Totally natural human behavior to do that. But yeah, so totally. So to move over to defend, because I think this is probably more interesting in terms of the overall strategy here. And I think also it's, listeners may have some particular concerns about a long short fund that they would not have about a long only fund, which is obviously more common and something that people are used to putting in their portfolio. So in terms of the overall risk, and I don't know how you're measuring that. Is it standard deviation? Is it betas? Is it max drawdown? Is a fund like Defend riskier than a long only fund like Lead, or does it actually involve less risk by being both long and short at the same time?
Yeah. So if I take off my SEC, you know, kind of fear hat, that I'll just answer this as plainly as possible, and then I'll try to put some disclosures after this.
Yeah, sure.
I designed this. I was a financial advisor for many years at Morgan Stanley before launching the Reality Shares business, and I had, I mean, we all financial advisors had those clients that just said, you know, would call right at the bottom and say, "Get me out, get me absolutely out of the market." And you know, we would even kind of tease and say, "Oh, Harry called. You know, he wants to get out of the market. It's probably time to buy." Those clients, I always wish that there was a fund that I could just have as a defensive kind of halfway house, where either they already owned it because it was an all weather type of strategy, or I could say, you know, Harry, instead of let's get out of the market, how about we just get into something that's slightly more defensive, just in case the market recovers. It's got some exposure, but it's kind of like a parachute. You know, it's got some risk controls to it associated with it. And that was some of the inspiration behind why we built Defend the way we did. So Defend has 75% of its assets in the long position. So these are high quality businesses that generally outperform the S&P 500 over time, and generally actually do so with a little bit less risk. So even just Lead as a whole, that strategy has what we say 80% downside capture and 100% of the upside capture. So it captures about 100% of the market in good times and about 80% of the downside in bad times. Not perfect, but just statistically speaking, kind of going back over time. And that makes sense too. These are higher quality companies. They're less likely to be sold when markets sell off, and they're more likely to keep pace with the market when markets are really running. Defend takes a 75% long position in those. So those are already, you know, somewhat defensive. And then a 25% position short in the worst companies. Now, so really you only have half of your money in kind of beta or net market exposure. So if you give me a dollar, I buy 75 cents of the good companies, I short 25 cents of what we consider the bad companies, hoping that the bad companies will go down more and go up less, and vice versa, the good companies will go up as much and go down less. And so you really only have 50 cents invested in the market from if just everything goes up 1% when the market goes up 1% and vice versa, down 1%, 1%. So from that perspective, it's quite a bit safer. And you would think and expect it to underperform by about 50% when markets are good and outperform by about 50% when markets are bad. But as you see, and as you pointed out, here we are kind of outperforming the market by a lot, and yet the market is pretty much flat. And we've been able to do it actually in up markets and in down markets. And the primary reason for that is just because the short positions go down more generally when markets go bad, and they go up less when markets are good, and vice versa on the upside. So that's a really long answer to that question. Now, putting the SEC hat back on, it's if you know, nothing is ever guaranteed, and past performance has nothing to do with future results. But actually, where it goes wrong is when those short positions really rally, and that's I consider these dash for trash type markets, when there's a bailout or there's, you know, some scenario where those short positions, because they're volatile positions and they've already most likely been beaten down, you know, and so they can have significant rallies. And that's why we only put a 25% position into those holdings, because they can significantly rally. 2016 actually was a year where everybody wanted yield. There was a ton of money chasing these kind of lower quality utility companies with high yields. And so those low quality companies with high yields outperformed, and the high quality companies in the lead basket did well. They just kind of trapped the market, but those short positions really outperformed. So if you wanted to find kind of a bummer year for defend, you could look back at 2016, and even that wasn't necessarily a bad year. I can't remember what we were up, but we didn't keep pace with that 50% of the market exposure. Mm-hmm.
And why are the expenses so high on this fund? I assume it has something to do with short borrowing costs, but just curious to hear from you. So you've got a gross expense ratio of 1.38% on defend versus just about a quarter of that on lead.
Yeah, the actual expense ratio or the fees that we get paid are 0.85. So that's the fee. But the SEC has a way report or forcing mutual funds to report the dividends and all the short borrowing expenses of funds. If you're short actual stocks versus a swap or other things, you have to show all of the dividends that you pay. Because when I borrow a stock and sell it to someone else, that person that I borrowed it from still wants the dividends that they were entitled to. Sure. They don't even know that I borrowed it most of the time. So I have to pay those dividends. And as we know, or as hopefully some of your listeners know, when a stock goes X dividend, the price goes down by that dividend. So if I'm short that stock, I get the benefit of the stock dropping, but I receive the dividends, or in this case, I have to pay the dividend. So really it's a wash for the investors. However, and I'm not gonna fight City Hall on this, the SEC still wants us to show that as an expense to the fund. So we have to show all of those dividends that we're paying on the shorts, even though, again, like I say, we're getting them back in performance because the stocks are dropping by that dividend. But that's just a function of reporting purposes. So there's an 85 basis point fee to manage the fund, and then the rest of it is short sale expenses. It is more expensive, but again, net, I mean, this is a the way we designed this fund was really, this is like an award-winning hedge fund type return from a risk and return perspective. and it certainly doesn't have the 2% and 20% management.
I was going to say, and yet you're not taking 2% and 20%.
Right.
Quite the opposite.
It's always a balance. Yeah. It's difficult in the ETF. I mean, we really, you know, kind of one of my whole theses on why I left Morgan Stanley was I was able to offer my clients, you know, these ultra wealthy clients, these hedge funds and these great returns, but I wasn't able to offer them to my neighbor. I wasn't even allowed to buy or invest in some. And yet I was, you know, recommending them to clients. And it just irked me. And so that was why we really built the firm, to enable investors to get some of those same exposures that the kind of ultra wealthy already had access to.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. It's, you hear that from a lot of people that ended up in the ETF space, that they're trying to democratize markets, make these kinds of high-end strategies affordable to people that just want to maybe put a small amount in them and aren't already wealthy. So yeah, it's definitely appreciated by regular investors, that's for sure. So I'd like to take things back to the macro level a bit here before we wrap things up. We're obviously in a historically low rate environment right now. I believe, and I think the market believes also, we will be there for a very long time. All of this stimulus and all of the quote-unquote printing that the Fed has been doing, obviously they're not actually printing money. That shows up on the balance sheet of the Treasury, and they have to replace those all of that debt that they're rolling out, and they have to keep borrowing costs debt servicing costs, sorry, reasonably low, so that the U.S. government still has money to pay for things other than servicing debt. And so we're likely to see rates low for a very long time. We're also likely to see some companies still cut dividends that haven't yet, as second wave closures happen, and companies that have been able to hold out but have been seeing their cash piles dwindle over time forced to cut. What's your expectation in terms of what investors can expect here from dividend paying stocks and from rates in general as we continue to weather this COVID storm?
Yeah, so I think that you're spot on. I think that rates are going to stay low for a really long time, that productivity is going to continue to struggle, just the economy as a whole, you know, in real terms growth is just going to struggle for a very long time. And so cash flows at these businesses are going to be constrained. And the easy answer of, you know, for example, I'm just looking for higher yielding stocks, and so I'm just going to filter by yield. That is not going to be a good strategy, because you're going to end up with a bunch of yield traps that, you know, just you can get by with in a great economy, because the company will earn its way out of its own problem. But in a poor economy, all of those things, you know, you really learn. It's almost like when the tide goes out, you learn who's not wearing a bathing suit. And this is that time. So
totally. I mean, if anything, those companies, the yields may look artificially high because the markets anticipating potential insolvency or issues have already punished those stocks in terms of the share price. And so when you run a screen, the yields look really high. And the reality is that the company's cutting of the dividend just hasn't caught up to what the market has already figured out in terms of the share price there. So really, really could be a potentially very dangerous strategy in this kind of an environment.
Yeah. Yeah. And then even when you go down let's just say, because this call was primarily focused on dividend growth, so let's take it down a notch and say, okay, well, I only want to buy the highest quality companies. And I'm going to view that as any company who grew their dividend for 25 years in a row, in the case of the aristocrats. Well, that is a heavily flawed strategy potentially too, because yeah, these are good businesses that have been around for a long time, but that does not mean that they're going to be able to grow their earnings and cash flows and all of the things that you really want as an investor in order to maintain that dividend growth rate. Look at Chevron and Exxon and, you know, those are great businesses, yes, because they've been around and they're stable and they're not going anywhere. But for what price do you want to pay for these stocks? So you really have to be careful that if you're going to, say, blindly just invest in a company because of its history, at least pay the right price for it. So, So DivCon, I just always viewed as this way of, well, I want to identify the best businesses, the companies with the best potential to grow in an economy, regardless of the economy. And that way I can at least be a little bit less sensitive to the price that I'm paying for those companies, because the growth will be there to support that over time. And again, you can't just look at, say, the growth index, or the, you have to look for the underlying fundamentals. Are they there in order to support that growth? And then just, you know, diversify and like all of the other tenants that, you know, don't put all your eggs in one basket and don't load up on the market just because it went up in the past 6 months, for example. That doesn't mean it's going to go up in the next 6 months. We could be, you know, ready for another dip here. That's, I think everybody needs to be really prepared for that.
Yes, certainly. And of course, part of the problem with these dividend aristocrats is that because they've raised dividends so many years in a row, investors develop a personal relationship with the companies, with the stock, and they just can't see their portfolio without that position inside of it because of how long the company's been successful for. And the bottom line is that you really do need, especially at times like this, but really at all times, a strategy which is dispassionate, which takes the personal biases out of the equation, and which just looks at the numbers and judges all companies on an equal basis and takes away that emotional connection investors often have, or that history, which is great, but doesn't necessarily say anything about where the stock is going to go from here.
Yeah. Yep. That's absolutely right. It's just, again, kind of coming up with your strategy. And the beauty is, you know, again, for the do-it-yourself investor, it's just such a cool time to be an investor where there's no commissions at most of the major custodians. And there's so many ETFs out there. So let's just say you loved everything we talked about today and you really are, you know, anti-fee. Just go on the website, open up the ETF, look at the holdings, and go buy each one of those. You know, if you wanted to, and you wouldn't even have to pay a single commission. It's a pretty cool time to be an investor where you can come up with your own strategy, something that fits for you. And if you do buy ETFs, great. You can buy them for, you know, commission free. It's just a neat time to be an investor.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would caution people against, let's say, if you're going to go out and rebuild this basket exactly, you may not be paying a fee on the trades, but you will be paying a spread on every one of those trades. And so, you know, it should be tight for S&P 500 companies, but it still may be a much more profitable strategy in the long run for many do-it-yourself investors to go out and buy a fund and just pay that bid-ask spread once, as opposed to having to get in and out of positions 50 or 100 times a year.
Yeah, and thank you for saying that.
It's worth keeping in mind.
Exactly. We are here for a reason. You know, I feel like the fees that we charge are pretty fair. And, you know, the amount of work that goes into every day, from corporate actions to even just the tax benefits of ETFs, where I don't know, you know, a lot of people don't know this, but if we turn over our portfolio 70% per year, if an individual investor had to do that, that individual investor is going to pay all of the capital gains taxes on all the companies that they sell. And then, you know, if they're gains, and then vice versa, they'll do it again next year and next year and next year. In a mutual fund, the same thing would be true. In an ETF, what we do is we have in-kind creations and redemptions. So we ship out all of the stocks that we don't want, and then we receive in all the stocks that we do want. And the cost basis, it's as if there was no transaction from a tax perspective. So that's incredibly valuable to end investors, because they're not getting kicked out these capital gains every year. So you can have a fund with pretty high turnover and yet not have any of the underlying taxes. It's not a guarantee. You know, the fund manager doesn't have to do what I just described, but most ETF managers that care would and do. So it's a real big benefit for end investors that a lot of people don't even know is happening.
Sure. Yeah. You have those authorized participants coming in, of course, when me or any other retail investor goes and buys an ETF on your broker, that's actually a secondary market transaction. So it's, again, you get the benefit of all of that financial engineering and magic. Of course, not in all cases. It's not always possible to avoid paying out some kind of a taxable event at the end of the year on exchange-traded funds, but certainly very minimized compared to mutual funds or doing it yourself outside of a tax-deferred portfolio. So yeah, there's no question about that. Anyway, Eric, I want to thank you for being so generous with your time here. What's the best way for investors to continue researching everything we've been discussing here today?
For starters, is the websites. We have the two websites. One is kind of the exchange-traded fund website. That's realityshares.com. Reality, not realtyshares.com. And then a ton of good information on there. If you want to just learn generally about the DivCon fund or the DivCon methodology or the DivCon funds, you can play around there. If you want more of the open source stuff that I was talking about, or lots of tools about the DivCon system and the underlying holdings and the scores, then go to realityshareadvisors.com. I think that's really helpful. And anyone can, of course, follow me on Twitter at EERVIN. And then, LinkedIn, all of the normal places as well. But those are probably the best places.
Sure. And I can tell listeners from following Eric that you've got some great stuff on Twitter. You're definitely active there. You're not one of these people that just kind of has the account but never checks it. So worthwhile if you do the social media thing to follow Eric there.
Thanks, John.
Anyway, want to wish you health and sanity in all of the craziness going on here and continued success with these really unique funds that you've put out there that have really just done a great job crushing the market. And I guess if things go as you would want them to, we'll continue to on a forward basis. Caveat emptor.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I really appreciate the time. And again, just a great conversation as well.
For disclosures, Eric Ervin is long LEAD and DFND. Jonathan List doesn't have positions in any of the stocks or funds discussed in today's show.
If you've been enjoying Let's Talk ETFs, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. And if you find this podcast useful, please consider leaving a review on one of those platforms so that other investors can discover it. You can also find this podcast on SeekingAlpha.com by typing Let's Talk ETFs into the search bar at the top of the site.